Well, we're always talking about the Federal Reserve. In fact, don't fight the Fed is one of the common adages of Wall Street. Well, we have today what Peggy calls, this is her Fed guy. She calls you the Fed guy, by the way.
I've been called the worst.
And we are pleased to have with us today Douglas Roberts. Doug is managing principal for Channel Capital Research Institute. He's a contributor to AOL's Money and Finance section, is frequently called upon by the media. I'm sure you've seen him on CNN, CNN Money, Dow Jones Newswire. This man's everywhere, and you are Peggy's expert on the Federal Reserve. So what I'd like to know is, first of all, what are your thoughts on Mrs. Yellen? I understand she's a very bright woman. In fact, Alan Greenspan was being interviewed one day. This is before her official acceptance as Fed chairman. He says, you know, I basically understand 95% of all the reports that are given me, and the other 5% I don't understand. I always go to Janet Yellen, she explains it to me. But on the other hand, I've heard some other things. I've heard some concerns out there that if the economy gets really out of hand, you know, if we start getting rampant inflation, I don't remember, and I'm sorry to say I don't, but I heard somebody say the other day that she's no Paul Volcker, and he was saying it very much in the same way that that I think Lloyd Benson said when he was talking to Dan Quayle, you're no Jack, I knew Jack Kennedy, and you're no Jack Kennedy. And that's really what he was saying, is that, you know, if we really get into trouble, if we have really, really high inflation, this person was not convinced that she would respond properly. So I've kind of set that up so you could take it from here. But what are your thoughts on Janet Yellen?
Well, I think what you have to understand is really the Fed is more than one person, and it's also more reactive to the current situations. Fed chairmen are appointed by presidents. And in essence, what happens is if the president doesn't get the desired result that he wants from a particular chairman relative to a situation, he will replace that person. So although we like to think of the Fed as a totally independent institution, it's only semi-independent. It is somewhat linked to the nature of the economy and reacting to it. And then sometimes in those situations, it's more a creature of circumstance and how to react to it versus something where they can actually do it. Now, we go back to Paul Volcker as an example. Paul Volcker took a very, very tight monetary policy stance and was credited with whipping inflation. But we have to realize that monetary policy, with apologies to Milton Friedman, is actually a confirming indicator of inflation, not necessarily the underlying cause of it. In other words, for inflation to be present, then you have to have basically an excess of money, but you ultimately have to have an excess of basically demand over supply for inflation to occur. Mm-hmm. Now, what you had really with the underlying causes of inflation during the 60s and then 70s, the hyperinflation, was it was really caused by a shortage of oil, caused by the OPEC cartel first, and then later on also caused by really the Iranian Revolution, which took about 10% of the world's oil supply. Now, once oil prices rise, you have one option: you can continue to print money, or at that point in which the inflation is confirmed and the economy and credit continues to become available, or you have a situation where you can tighten monetary policy, in which case you get a severe recession. And if it's severe enough, it leads to a depression. You had that during the 73-74 bear market. And you also had that to a lesser extent during the early 80s when Paul Volcker increased his tightening. Mm-hmm. And you have to realize that Ronald Reagan's unpopularity was quite high then. It was only really in 82 when the economy started picking up. And then what happened was, it was really, in my opinion, not due totally to Mr. Volcker's tightening, but the fact that the OPEC oil cartel broke and oil prices started to decrease, which allowed him to tighten. So right now, I mean, what you're seeing is everybody, if you look at it, and part of my situation here, inflation is really a link to basically war. His war interrupts international trade, puts basically a forced investment into non-productive assets. You're buying bombs, you're blowing things up, and then you have to replace them. It doesn't really lead to any productivity, although sometimes the technology used to do that can lead to enhanced productivity after the war ends. Mm. We saw that, and again, with apologies to Al Gore, the internet was really something that developed from a RAPNet, which was a government network designed really if there was a nuclear holocaust, that communication could basically be maintained among government agencies. The internet really only developed and was declassified and then basically open to the public. So what you're right now seeing is, I don't see inflation really on the horizon. You're starting to possibly get more of it, but there's still, even despite the amounts of wars, with the potential for basically interruption of trade, that excess of demand over supply, but you don't really see it. Because at each point, you get the excess demand, supply comes from overseas to basically fill those voids in terms of labor. That's one of the reasons why, basically, if you look at a lot of the reports, there hasn't been labor. That's not to say that it can't arise.
Right.
But at that point, it may be because of a geopolitical circumstance. And then at that point, it could be very, very similar to Paul Volcker or to what happened under earlier Fed chairman during the OPEC oil embargo of the early 70s, at which point if Janet Yellen becomes too tight and we tend to go into a recession or even something which I call a near depression. And then at that point, usually presidents being the way they are want to get reelected. So
yeah.
At that point, they kind of have a limited pen, and unless it starts to work, then at that point, they get a new Fed chairman who really starts to be more accommodative to them, or if not, in the case of George Bush, when Alan Greenspan was not as accommodative at that point, he still to this day credits Alan Greenspan the fact that his delay in loosening monetary policy in response to really the Gulf War was one of the reasons why he didn't get reelected.
And why we went into a kind of a recession.
Correct.
Now, do you feel that what they'll probably do then is that if we get into a situation like that, if I understand correctly, they'll allow Mrs. Yellen to see what she's going to do, and then if she doesn't respond appropriately, if the economy doesn't respond the way that they want it, then they can go in and replace her? Do they just fire the Federal Reserve Chairman? I think that...
Well, she's on with a term, but basically the term has to be generally renewed by the president, and then at that point, the president really almost has a similar influence on the Federal Reserve that you're seeing on the Supreme Court, except it's not lifetime terms. So at that point, if you look at it right now, one of the reasons why Alan Greenspan, if you look at history, he was up for re-election in really 96,
right,
as was Bill Clinton. And at that point, he opted to basically continue stimulating monetary policy because of the problems really with overseas finance. Now, one can say that was an independent decision really well, but coincidentally, it had to coincide with basically both re-election of the president and re-election of him.
So the Fed is not a completely political animal, though, but it's controlled by...
I would say it's by influenced. It's not a totally independent body, but it's not kind of, shall we say, an agency, kind of like the U.S. Treasury, where all of a sudden
right. They
report to really the, basically the president and really the, to let's say a government branch.
I love to ask some questions. We've only got about a minute to go, but because I'd like to know, first of all, I'll just ask this very quickly. Is there anything like it anywhere in the world? Is the Federal Reserve unique?
At this point, I'd say it's first among equals, to use the old mafia saying. It's the most powerful entity because we are the most powerful economy and we're the world's reserve currency, but you kind of have that with the ECB and you also have that with basically the BOJ, the Bank of Japan.
Right.
As well within the developed world. So you do have comparable entities. I'd say it has to be a global central bank as opposed to a minor central bank of a secondary economy as well. Now, some of them are more subservient to the, to the central government. Others are less so, and sometimes that varies during particular time periods of history as well.
Well, Peggy and I are still out at the Money Show, and we're recording in the hallways, believe it or not. So if you hear background noise, it's because people walk by us and they chat and they kind of stare at us. But we're really fortunate today to have with us Doug Roberts. Doug is managing principal for Channel Capital Research Institute. We're talking about the Fed today, and he's come out with a book. It's called "Follow the Fed to Investment Success: The Effortless Strategy for Beating Wall Street." Now, think about this, folks. I mean, an effortless strategy for beating Wall Street. Who would not want to see this? So go to Amazon.com. It's Douglas S. Roberts, Follow the Fed to Investment Success, The Effortless Strategy on Beating Wall Street. Can Doug, can we talk a little bit about the book, about what's in it, and about what is this strategy? Because you'll be speaking here or tomorrow, as a matter of fact. By the time this airs, we'll all be home. But the topic of your presentation is Follow the Fed and Investment Strategy for Bull and Bear Markets. So let's talk about what's in the book.
Well, ultimately, Mike, one of the things you've heard is, you've heard the saying, money makes the world go round.
Yes, it does.
Actually, I'd like to really adopt that. It's really not money makes the world go round, it's credit makes the world go round. Because ultimately, the ability to credit, a large part of the number of transactions are done based on credit. If you had something where basically people had to carry around mounds and mounds of cash, they wouldn't be able to do it. So we have a banking system where if you had something where kind of like it was only COD, and you know, you get down to barter, where kind of like they're sitting there doing something, you'd severely restrict the marketability of the economy. It's really the availability of credit which drives everything and drives markets, which drives economics. It also drives the financial markets as well, particularly the stock market. And what I find is sometimes those cycles were concurrent, and basically you had a market cycle equivalent to an economic cycle, equivalent to a credit cycle. Other times, and in most cases, you had the credit cycle leading slightly, but sometimes you can also have a situation where the market and economic cycles diverge, which I think is currently the case where we had now. What I just did with the book was I said, therefore, the Fed may be able to tell us what areas to invest in, not just what particular stocks, but there's been a lot of research showing it's really not so much the individual securities you invest in, it's being in the right types of securities.
Right.
Whether they be value, growth, small cap, large cap. And in this book, I address one aspect of that, which is small cap and large cap. And what I really found is I said there's got to be a way that we can quantify this so that we can figure out how it drives the investment markets. Now, what you find is most asset managers, some estimates have been as high as 90% of them in the long term, don't beat the S&P 500.
Right.
So if you can beat the S&P 500 consistently over an extended period of time, that's a relatively unique thing and puts you into what I call the creme de la creme of asset management.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we've heard of the small cap anomaly where over time small cap stocks do beat large cap stocks by as much as 2 or 3%. Sometimes the estimates have been as high, depending upon the time period, as much as 4%. The real question is they come in short, sporadic bursts. And the question is how do you take advantage of those bursts? Because outside of them, actually small caps really lag large cap stocks like the S&P 500. A perfect example of that was, you know, during really the 80s and 90s. During the 70s, small caps were on fire during the so-called bear market of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Once you got into the latter half of the 70s, small caps were on fire. Then at that point, roughly in the early 80s, it switched and stayed that way, except for maybe tiny, tiny periods of small cap outperformance for 18 years. Most people would not have had the wherewithal to stick with 18 years of underperformance until finally small caps really rallied around 2000, 2001, 2002, and have really been at the forefront of basically the markets outperformance-wise since then for the last 12, 13 years. How do you isolate those periods? And what I found was a common denominator was really whether the Fed was stimulating monetary policy. But I also found it was not necessarily what the Fed said, but you had to track them by kind of interest rates as well to find out how it was actually done. And the bottom line was, what I found the big correlating factor was negative real interest rates. That was really where all the Fed outperformance came. It came during concentrated periods, not that many of them, but relatively short, some of them more extended. And that if you could take advantage of those periods, you were able to get something with about the volatility or slightly more volatility than the S&P 500, but about 3% of outperformance without a lot of trades.
This surprises me because I thought when you were talking, I think, well, does that mean, because you say they come in short spurts, I said, does that mean that a person or an entity has to trade more frequently in order to achieve these results? And you're saying no.
No. Actually, let's say over a 75-80 year period, you may have only had 14, 15 trades.
Wow.
And at that point, you can even reduce that even further using a proprietary filter that I developed as well. But I kind of look at the history of how this developed, and this is only one aspect where how you can use what I call monetary environment flow analysis, of which the Fed is one of the basically the driving factors behind that, along with the other global central banks, which tend to follow the Fed's lead. And that has become even more of a driving force, I think, in the last, since the turn of the century right now, the turn of this century, that is, the beginning of the 21st.
Now, this is very sophisticated information, not something I would think the average investor or even the average professional can do. Is this something that your company does, the Channel Capital Research? Is this something that you do? Do you have newsletters?
What we do is we have a newsletter and a tracking service for a couple of these variables, and you can keep your strategy very, very simple, which using one or two indicators, which I describe in the book. And then also, you can also go with more sophisticated indicators depending upon how much work you want to do. But ultimately, none of them are really that much short-term trading, because one of the things you have to remember, and also they're not really individual stock picks. It's just you have to have the discipline to stick to it and really know what you're comfortable with and what you're willing to do. You have to know your own limitations, I guess.
Absolutely.
According to the great Dirty Harry. Yeah,
according to the great Dirty Harry, that's right.
Man's got to know his limitations, not to be sexist, also women as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you do that, you can really set up something. Or as the great Jesse Livermore once said, one of the greatest traders, said the hardest thing that he has is just sitting on your hands and not doing anything
right. To
really let the trade develop.
Yeah, people tend to get itchy trigger fingers about investing in the market, and sometimes they don't realize that cash is not a bad place to be at certain times. And that's one of the hallmark differences between a professional trader and an amateur trader,
yeah,
is that sometimes the professional trader knows that there's a game on, and sometimes they know that the game is not there, and so they just sit on the sidelines.
It also depends. Sometimes you have to realize what's more important to you at your particular stage in life, protecting the downside or protecting the upside. And that's different for every person, and we give you a variety of strategies in our toolkit to deal with it.
Yeah, how do they get a hold of the newsletter? Can you give us the information for that?
Yeah, the easiest way to do is to go to our website, which is actually channelcapitalresearch.com. That gives you a whole bunch of free information,
okay,
and gives you information on how to sign up for the newsletter. So again, that's channelcapitalresearch.com.
Yeah, and the book, folks, you've got to get this book now. And it has a great cover. I don't know who designed that cover. Great cover. Follow the Fed to Investment Success, the Effortless Strategy for Beating Wall Street. I think that's excellent. So anyway, folks, I think we are wrapping up. Is that where we're wrapping up, Peggy? Or where are we? You're not sure. Peggy, we got about a minute to go, I think. And you can hear all this. Peggy's getting a little upset because we've got all this noise going on. But I just have to ask you one quick question. What do you think of Bitcoin?
Bitcoin, the problem that you have there is really who's behind it to make sure that it operates by the rules. Who at that point kind of like supervises it? To make sure that there's no fraud and everything else. Who stands behind it to make sure that the actual story is what you're going to be getting?
Yeah, and it does, and we don't seem to know that yet. I mean, I was quite alarmed when Mt. Gox went out of business, and quite alarmed when they opened up one day and just all their Bitcoins were gone. And I assume at some point they actually have to convert it to U.S. dollars. I don't know. We'll see. So anyway, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. Doug, it's just a pleasure to have you on. We look forward to having you back. Thank you.
Great to be here, Mike, and thank you.